On that we will agree. Genesis chapter 37 this morning. This will be our Wednesday lesson for Vacation Bible School. For the youth, it'll be Tuesday night. And again, just to remind you, they're a night ahead each night because they're our helpers the next day, and we want them prepared so that they can talk about with the kids the next day what is going on. And that's part of what this endeavor as well is to help all of the workers that are going to be around the kids. This gives us a running jump start ahead to be prepared for the lessons that we will be learning. I will remind you where we've been. We've been in Genesis chapter 1. We saw in Genesis chapter 1 that God created the sun, the moon, and the stars. And part of the theme that week is going to be to get the young children to walk outside and to do what? To look up. I've already been looking ahead at the moon, and we couldn't have planned a better week. That Sunday is a new moon, which means on Monday when we go out, we won't be able to see it at all. But on Tuesday evening, Lord willing, if the clouds are not around, those kids will be able to go out Tuesday evening at sunset, and they'll begin to pick that moon out as we progress through the week. And so it is a very good time for them to begin to appreciate and understand what God has done. But God didn't just create it just to look good. He created them for signs, for season, and in times. And in Genesis chapter 15, God takes Abram out of his tent, has Abram look up at the stars, and says, Abram, if you can count them, so will the number of your offspring be. And we know the stars are innumerable, and Abram was given a great promise. As we begin chapter 37 this morning, we're going to kind of draw that plan together because these are not disconnected. Genesis chapter 1 focuses on the fact that God gave us the heavens, the stars, the sun, and the moon for signs, for seasons, and wonders. What we did not cover in great detail, at least on the Sunday we looked at Genesis 1, that Adam and Eve sinned, and because Adam sinned, death passed upon all men. Well, God had a plan, and part of that plan involved Abram, and when he had Abram walk outside and count those stars, that was God giving Abram the promise that salvation was coming. One of those stars, as we see in this chapter this morning, is Joseph. Now, if you go down through the time long enough, if you're a professing believer in Christ, one of those stars is you. If you are a believer in Christ by faith, you are spiritually an offspring of Abraham. And one of those stars he saw was you being counted there. It's all interconnected. Well, a Joseph is a descendant of Abraham. He is the great-grandchild of Abraham. Isaac begat Jacob. Jacob begat Joseph. And that is where we're going to pick up with a 17-year-old young man as God prepares Joseph for what he's going to have for him to do. Now, I'd be willing to bet most of us are saying, yes, I would like God to use me, but if you found out God using you is going to mean a time in prison, you'd be like, forget it. Right? Happens with Joseph. It happened with Paul and Silas. They're going to end up in prison, not for things they've done wrong, at least the way God views it, but what man viewed as wrong. Well, God has a plan even when it involves prison, even when it involves evil, rough times. In this, God is preparing Joseph. And beginning with verse 1 and verse 2, we see this. Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father, Isaac, was a stranger in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. We learn from an early age, Joseph isn't a snitch, but he has a discernment for right. Now, too many times what we read that passage, I've heard people say, well, he's just going to tell on his brothers. He's a tattletale. He's a snitch. No, you're making it too much like ourselves. Joseph is exalting the good. If they're doing something that's going to harm their father, if they're doing something that's going to harm the flocks, that is not good for the family, it is good to speak up. Okay, I've got a little paper here on my desk that says, don't ask you for amens, but let's go ahead and nail this nail down and get it firmly sunk that even a cat's claw can't get it out. You have an obligation. You have an obligation for the bride of Christ to speak for that which is true and that which is righteous and that which upholds God's goodness. You have not been called to be silent. You have been called to speak up. It's not being a snitch. If the bride of Christ has a cancer, we need to deal with it. We'll deal with it in our body. We'll get things cut out and have infections and reactions to it, but hopefully we're going to live longer. Ask Brother John. He got a great story. We'll do it with our own bodies. If somebody tells us, man, you need to lose that piece of skin on your face, otherwise skin cancer is going to get you, we'll get rid of it. Thank God there are doctors willing to speak up and offend your ears to save your life. We're not talking about saving just lives. We're talking about saving souls. We have an obligation to speak up. Joseph is not a snitch. He upholds that which is right. He stands for that which is right as we watch his life unfold. There's not too many people, aside from Jesus and the Scriptures, where we can look at and say, man, everything presented about them is stellar. Joseph is one of them without a flaw that is mentioned. He has a stellar witness, a stellar example as it unfolds, even though he goes and tells his father the truth. In verses 3 and 4, we find out that Israel, or another name for Jacob there, he loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Not just that, but he's the son of Rachel, the wife that Jacob really loved. So you've got four wives. You love one more than the others. There's going to be jealousy and envy. And you've got the son from the wife that you love. Even though he's number 11 down the line, he is now preeminent in the home. That's going to offend number one, number two, number three, number four, ad nauseum down the list. Jacob loves Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. Talk about stand out, huh? Still amazes me, people that would dress completely opposite of what normal society would be. And they're like, I'm not trying to call attention to myself. Really? If you walked in this church wearing a clown costume right now and expect me not to point you out, I'm not the problem. Joseph is going to stand out as if he were wearing a clown costume because he is one of 12 and he is brightly colored when he walks in. Everywhere they look, there is this stand out, loved of his father more than we are loved. You don't have to be taught that envy is going to come in. You recognize envy is jealousy are going to enter into this. And you find that in verse 4. When his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him. And they hated him in so much that they could not even speak peaceably unto him. Now make sure you understand that's strong. You know, you've been so angry you couldn't speak, right? You know, if you just speak, it ain't no telling what'll come flying out of the mouth. This is hatred. They are so hateful that they cannot say anything good to him. There is a deep rift in this family. But when we come to verse 5, something changes for our vision, our standpoint for Joseph. Joseph is beloved by his father, but he is also a chosen vessel of God. And beginning in verse 5, Joseph dreamed a dream. He told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood around about and made obeisance or bowed down and honored my sheaf. And his brethren said to him, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream and told it to his brethren and said, behold, I've dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance or bowed down to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to you to the earth?" And his brothers envied him, but his father observed the saying. Now there are two dreams that Joseph has that are revealed to us here in this passage. The one is the sheaves. The second one I'm going to focus more upon because it links us with Genesis 1. It links us with Genesis 15 and Abram. And we see that Joseph had a dream about the stars, the sun, and the moon as God had given it to him. Now, dreams in Genesis are not out of the ordinary. Dreams are used by God in chapter 20 to tell Abimelech, "Don't you touch Sarah, Abraham's wife." Remember, Abraham had told him, "Oh, she's my sister." And God said, "You touch her, you're a dead man." You can find that in Genesis chapter 20. If you go back and look in Genesis chapter 31, while Jacob is in the far country with his father Laban working for him, God comes to Jacob in a dream and says, "Take your family, and I want you to go back home. You go back where you're from." That occurs in a vision. Well, Laban's not happy about that, and he gets angry. He's going to go run after him. And God taps him on the shoulder in a dream and says, "Don't you harm Jacob. Don't you say anything good to him, and don't you say anything bad to him." Basically, he told Laban, "Shut up." In a dream. And then a couple of chapters forward from now, Pharaoh is going to have a dream, a great vision. Seven fat cows, seven skinny cows, seven fat ears of grain, seven skinny ears of grain. And we'll see that as we unfold the story this morning. But God uses dreams in Genesis to communicate great truths to his people. But especially in this one, God used the sun, the moon, and the stars. In Job chapter 33, and sometimes we need to be careful who we listen to in Job, but this is one of the good men speaking. This is Elihu, the young guy. He waits till all the old guys are done talking. He says, "Guys, I've had it with y'all's talking. Y'all ain't speaking right about God, and you ain't speaking right about Job." And this is from Elihu, the good one. And by the way, God does not condemn Elihu. He condemns the first three, but Elihu is not listed in God's condemnation. Listen to what Elihu has to say about dreams. Job 33, "For God speaks in one way in another, yet no one notices, in a dream, in a vision in the night, when deep sleep falls upon men as they slumber on their beds, he opens their ears and terrifies them with warnings, to turn a man from wrongdoing and keep him from pride, to preserve his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword." In other words, God will talk to men in their dreams when their logic is out of the way, when their hidings are out of the way, when God can catch a man when he is completely vulnerable. Most of you have had a dream that has scared you spitless. You woke up shaking, shivering. You had to have a glass of water. You probably had to have a bucket of water. You were just... Dreams have that ability to do that. Well, Elihu says, God speaks to men in dreams when their minds are out of the way. And he gives them visions. He gives them warnings to prepare them for what he's doing. Most notably in this, to turn you from the pit, to save your soul from the sword, as warnings. Well, Joseph is not being warned, but Pharaoh was being warned. There's a famine coming, Pharaoh. Preparations need to be made. Through that, Pharaoh is going to come to know about the one true God, Yahweh. But what I want you to keep in close connection, because we're thinking about all of this in one big giant picture, when God created the very stars, the sun and the moon, he had a plan. Remember when we looked at this, Abraham walked outside, and this is from Israel. That tent camp there is a campground, but this is the stars that can be seen above that campground. We need to find some new campgrounds other than ours, right? This is amazing. Abraham counted those stars. Joseph had a vision, a dream about some of those stars, the moon, the sun, and you can see the sheaves there as well. The whole picture there is showing they're obeying, not obeying, but they're giving obeisance. They're bowing down to, they're giving honor to Joseph. And all of this occurs in a dream. And I'm going to remind you one more time. What did God say He created the stars for, the sun, the moon? For signs, for seasons, and for times. They're beautiful. But it's not just for beauty. God uses these heavens that we see to communicate to us great happenings and great truth. Just for funsies, I'm going to say these fast, Peggy. Don't even try to write them down, okay? Revelation 1:16, Revelation 6:12, Revelation 8:12, Revelation 9:2, Revelation 12:1, and Revelation 6:8 all have God saying something in the future about these. But the one I want to focus on is Revelation chapter 8 and verse 12. I know some of y'all try to, I told y'all, don't try to write them down. You can see them after church. But 8:12 is what I do want you to notice. These stars, these heavens that God has created are going to be used by God yet in the future. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, a third part of the moon, and a third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. God is going to send an amazing display of His power, the ability to cause a third of the stars to cease to shine, at the same time a third of the sun ceases to shine, and at the same time a third of the moon ceases to shine. Now, if one of those events happened by itself, we might would say, whoa, that's pretty fascinating, right? But for all three to happen at the same time is a testimony that God judging this earth. God uses the sun, the moon, and the stars in a great and powerful way. I've told you this before, and I'm going to keep using it because this is, to me, the best biblical illustration. The darkness at noon at Passover when Jesus was crucified was not and could not be a solar eclipse. Absolutely impossible. Passover is a full moon feast. It occurs on the 14th day of the month, and the 14th day of the Jewish calendar month is always, did I say always? Always a full moon. It's not by our calendar because we're on a solar calendar. They went by a lunar, which means that on the day that Jesus was crucified, the full moon would have been completely opposite the earth to the sun. Sun, earth, moon. There is no way, unless God is doing a very big supernatural work, to move the moon between the sun and the earth on Passover. Absolutely impossible for man to do. But that's not what God did on the crucifixion. It was a supernatural darkness because there was nothing that should have hindered the sun to stop it from shining. And yet God cloaked the cross in darkness at Passover for 3 hours. That too was a sign. Interesting enough, it seems that it was the Roman soldier at the foot of the cross that picked up on it. How very few of the others actually understood that. The very same sun and moon and stars which were visible in Jesus' time were all used by God with Joseph. Now, if you look closely in verses 2, 3, and 8 in our passage, I've got just a short connection here, and this is another just for funsies. Joseph was a shepherd in verse 2. Jesus was the good shepherd, John chapter 10 and verse 14. Joseph was loved by his father, verse 2. Jesus was loved by beloved of his father, Matthew 3, verse 17. Joseph was hated by his brothers. You see that in verse 8. They tell us plainly they hated him. Jesus was hated by his own, John 15, verse 18. And he warns us, by the way, if they hate Jesus, they will hate us too. Joseph was sold for money. That's in chapter 37, verse 28. Jesus was betrayed for money in Matthew chapter 26. Joseph suffered before he was exalted. Jesus was crucified, beaten, whipped before he was exalted. Joseph saved his family by providing bread for them. Jesus is the bread of life, providing the spiritual nourishment that we need to be able to live. As Joseph was hated without cause, so was Jesus. I mean, if you walk up to somebody and tell them a dream, and even if that dream is not favorable for them, to hate a person because they had a dream? Really? You know, if y'all heard the funny little one, you know, somebody dreamed the both people. Man, I've already got myself in too far. I shouldn't have used this one. But anyway, I'll keep going. Two people were up on a roof and one fell off into a barrel of hot boogers and the other fell off into a barrel of honey. And so depending on who you're telling it to, like you would be telling it to Miss Jackie, you'd say, Jackie, I fell into the barrel of boogers and you fell into the barrel of honey. Now, at that moment, Jackie's thinking, finally, it's about time he realized something good for me. And Jim said, no, the part about it that really got me was I began to lick the honey off of you and you begin to lick the boogers off of me. And so the point there is, though, people use that. They say they had a dream, but it is not to communicate just simply information. It's really meant as a dig to the person they're talking to, right? Joseph simply conveying a dream that he had, but that's what the brothers saw it as, right? No, they didn't see it funny. Y'all thought that was funny. They hated him for his dreams. Without cause. But even in the midst of this, God is working out his plan. In chapters 39 through 41, Joseph is going to be sold into slavery by his brothers. He is going to be carried down into Egypt. He is going to be brought by a man, placed in the service in his house. He serves this man so faithfully. He is elevated secondly only to Potiphar. Potiphar's wife, she tries to get Joseph to sleep with her. He would not. He refused countless times because he was a man of great moral and upright character. Because he would not, she falsely accuses him. He is thrown into prison. In prison, he meets two other men, tells them what their dreams were. And just as God had shared with those men in those dreams what was going to happen, it came to pass. Joseph said, by the way, remember me when you stand back before the king. And what do we know? The man forgets about Joseph. Now, there's nothing that really irritates us more than when we do something good for somebody and they seem to forget us, huh? Oh, yeah. Joseph's an easy man. He's a man of good character, a man of uprightness. When Pharaoh has his dream, finally, the one good friend remembers that Joseph had told him what his dream was, and Joseph is brought out of the prison. And we pick up with that story in chapter 42. Joseph has already followed through with the story. He has set apart good while the land was flowing with lots of food. He is preparing for the time that famine would be coming upon the land. In chapter 42, when we pick up with verse 1, the famine has been greatly upon not just Egypt, but it has been upon Canaan, where his brothers live. The very brothers that sold him into slavery. And the story begins with this. Now, when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, why do you look one upon another? In other words, why are y'all standing around here starving to death? Do something about it. He said, behold, I have heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get you down there and buy for us from there that we may live and not die. Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn in Egypt. But Benjamin, Joseph's brother, Jacob sent not with his brethren, for he said, lest perhaps mischief should befall him. And the sons of Israel came to buy corn among those that came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan, and Joseph was the governor over the land, and it was Joseph that sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers, the 10, they came, and they bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. Remember what they said? Shall we bow down to you? Shall you have dominion over us? Here they are bowing down. And if Joseph says, no food for you, they would get no food. Who's got the authority now? Joseph does. Verse 7, Joseph saw his brothers, and he knew them. But he made himself strange. In other words, he made himself look different unto them, and he spoke roughly unto them. And he said unto them, From where have you come? And they said, To buy land of Canaan, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they did not know him. And Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them. Joseph remembered what God had shown him. I wonder what it is like to be so falsely accused that you would end up in jail, not of your own making, but the reason why that even happened in the first place is because your brothers sold you into slavery. Talk about marking the time on the wall, huh? When I get out of here, we're going to even the score. I'm putting BBs and all their valve stem caps on their cars. Well, we would loosen the nuts on their chariot wheels, okay? We don't find that in Joseph. Joseph is confident. God has shown him what was going to happen. There's no need to force it. There's no need to make it happen. It's simply a matter of God keeping His word. Last week I stood upon you a little bit about standing on the promises. If you don't know what promise you're standing on, how do you know if God's going to keep it or not? If you don't have something that you're hanging on to, how do you know if God does it or not? Joseph knows. And here are his brothers before him. Now, he's not being mean when he tells them that they're spies, that they have come to see the nakedness of the land. He is not being mean in that. It's not that. He is searching out their hearts. He is going to see what their motives are for being there, and they do not recognize him. We're going to fast forward to chapter 43, and we're going to look at verse 26. What happens in the meantime? Joseph gives them some food, but he, in questioning them, finds out that he has a younger brother. He knew he had a brother, but they didn't know who he was, Joseph. So he asking questions so that they would think he found out just by happenstance. Through the course of events there, he ends up telling them he would like to see this younger brother to prove their case. If I don't see your younger brother, y'all are all spies. And still, even though as we watch this unfold, this is not Joseph being mean. Joseph is concerned. If they did this to me, what did they do to Benjamin? Benjamin's the last living one, as far as they know, from Rachel. And we already know that Jacob loved Rachel the most. If Jacob thinks Joseph is dead, who's Jacob's affection going to turn to? Benjamin, the young one. Well, after a lot of that takes place, and Judah is trying to reason with Joseph about all of these things, finally, in verse 26, after some events unfold, when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house. And notice once again, they bowed themselves to the earth. And he asked them of their welfare and said, Is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? Is he yet alive? And they answered, Your servant, our father, is in good health. He is yet alive. And they bowed down their heads and made obeisance. Joseph had two dreams. They've bowed twice now. If God tells you something's going to happen, He doesn't have to tell you twice. All He really needs to do is tell you once. And if God tells you once, it's going to happen. If God repeats His word and tells you it's going to happen twice, make sure you're paying attention. It is definitive. It can't not happen. Jesus is coming back. How do we know that? He told us He was. Jesus is coming back. How do we know that? The angels that appeared to the apostles when Jesus went up said, He's coming back just like He said. But we also know from the Old Testament prophets that Jesus is going to come back and He's going to put His feet down on the top of Mount of Olives. Mount of Olives are going to split down the middle. We've got three testimonies, three witnesses that Jesus is coming back. How say some, He's not coming back. Jesus is coming back. You can write a check on that. You can bank on it. You can count on it. Jesus is coming back. They bow their faces, they bow to the ground, and once more in chapter 44, this happens once more. In chapter 44, after a few more events take place, Judah, in verse 14, and his brethren came to Joseph's house, for he was yet there, and they fell before him on the ground. Now, they're shaking in their boots because Joseph has the ability to say to them, off with their heads, but I want you to see, this is the third time now. They've bowed down to the one that they said, we will never bow down to you. You will never have authority over us. God said different. Now, God's plan took Joseph to the pit of a well, took him to slavery in Egypt, took him into Potiphar's house where he's falsely accused, puts him into prison where he is forgotten by a man. He speaks something good to him, but now he is standing next to Pharaoh, and he is only next to Pharaoh where Pharaoh's wife is concerned. Other than that, Joseph has rule over the land. They are bowing before the one. And listen, the Egyptians would have had no problem if Joseph had said, string them up right now. That's how much authority he has. He has authority in Egypt. But that's not the point of the story. The point of the story comes out in chapter 45. They find out who Joseph is. I'll start reading with verse 1. That'll be good context. Verse 45, verse 1, Joseph says the gig is up. Joseph could not refrain himself before all them that stood by him, and he cried, cause every man to go out from me. And there stood no man with him while Joseph made himself known unto his brethren. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I am Joseph. Does my father yet live? Second question doesn't even register with them. His brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. It was what he said at first, I am Joseph, that has their world rocked now. The one that's sitting on the throne next to Pharaoh, who they've been bowing before. I'm Joseph. They're troubled. Joseph said to his brothers, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near. And he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Now therefore, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me here, for God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years has the famine been in the land, and yet there are 5 years in the which there shall neither be eating nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. This was all God's plan. When he showed Joseph in the dream, in his visions, this was God's plan. You cannot thwart God's plan. You cannot. Who shall rise up and question him? Let's use Joseph as our chief example. Not Joseph, Job. Job questioned God. Didn't go so well with him. Man, you talk about what it must have been to hear that lecture, huh? Job, where were you when I did this, did that? Job, won't you run out? Won't you go grab Leviathan by the tail and tame him, Job? Go grab him and teach him what's right and what's wrong. Job can't do any of those things. At the conclusion of God's lecture to Job, Job says, you're God, I'm not. You're the great one. God's plan cannot be thwarted. And if you tie that into the one about Abram, God told Abram, I'm going to make you a great nation. And it matters not who tries to thwart it. Abram became a great nation and is still being made a great nation today. Everyone who comes to Christ by faith is an addition to the Abrahamic family and is God keeping his plan. But God was still doing something greater. If we go all the way back to God's creation, Adam sinned. God had a plan. He said that the seed of the woman would crush the seed of the serpent and it would crush the head of the serpent. God had a plan to save man, so he called Abram. He said, Abram, count the stars, and one of those stars was Joseph. And Joseph preserves his family. And because Joseph preserves the family, Judah is preserved. Because Judah is preserved, David is preserved. Because David is preserved, Jesus is preserved. Remember, Herod wanted to kill Jesus. God sent him down to Egypt. Herod dies and he brings his son back into the land. Why? Because God's plan cannot be thwarted. If God says it's going to come to pass, it's going to come to pass. And why did Jesus come? To save us from our sins. God's plan from the beginning, it was not afterthought. God's plan from the beginning is to save. And when you walk out and you look up at those stars, and I encourage you to, when you see that moon, and it was pretty bright this morning, it was giving off some glory this morning, that you don't just look and get caught up in His beauty, as glorious as it is, but that you pause and remember, my God's plan cannot be thwarted because my God's power cannot be thwarted. That moon is where it's at because God says that's where you're going to be. Those stars are where they're at because God said that's where you're going to be. That sun that comes up in the morning, I'm telling y'all, y'all got to get here early in the morning to watch the sunrise as it cuts across the corner. The stained windows give off different reflections depending on what day of the year it is, what time it is that they cut across here. And right now, the angle's coming through this. And it's that way next year, and it'll be that way the year after that. It'll be that way 1,000 years should the Lord tarry to come. And if this church had been here 1,000 years ago, it would have been the same. Why? Because God's power cannot be thwarted. And we need to be convinced of this, that when we look up, that God created these stars, the sun and the moon, the very ones He showed to Abram, the very ones He showed to Joseph. And in those stars, God revealed a plan whereby He would save man. Now, He would create the nation of the Jews through whom would come Jesus Christ, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the sons of Israel, Joseph preserving his family, pointing ultimately to Jesus who would preserve us by His own body. Joseph didn't die for his brethren. Jesus died for us. And what did Jesus call His disciples before He left them? I call you my friends. He laid His life down for His own beloved. God created, God planned, and you need to be convinced God saves. So when Paul writes these words under the inspiration of God's Holy Spirit, that if you'll confess with your mouth the Lord Jesus, and believe in your heart that God is raising from the dead, you shall be saved. Some people say, well, we can't know. Baloney. And that's being nice. John says, I wrote my gospel so that you can know Him and know that you're saved. That's why he wrote the first epistle. He says, so that you can know that you have a relationship with Him. Paul writes, you shall be saved. Why? For with the heart man believes unto righteousness. It's not what you do. You believe God, and with the mouth you confess, and confession leads to salvation. You're professing that truth. You confess what you believe. The problem is too many people that sit in the pews are repeating the words of the world rather than the words of the Word. It's not what the world decrees about you that you should be believing. It's what God says about you that you should be believing. We're told that we're conquerors, that we're overcomers. You're not a failure. You're not a loser. You may be weak to remedy your situation, but the Word tells me, greater is He that is in me than he that is in the world. I don't profess they're greater than me. Oh, you can beat me up. That's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said. Oh, you can throw us in the fire. We're still not going to worship your God. But we know this, even if our fate is determined by the fire, our God is still God. And even though He's got the power to save, even if He doesn't, we're still going to obey Him. Because they were convinced, what? He is God. Man, if I could teach and instruct an army of young children to walk into the school, the science class, when they're studying astronomy, and some highly educated teacher says, "Now, a billion years ago, these things smacked into being. And one by one, each one of these children stand up. God created. God created. God created." Because you're not an accident. The Word says man was created by God. And the young children that are going to be here for VBS need to know that. You're not an accident. You have a purpose and a plan in God's redemption history because God spoke. God created the stars. God created the sun and the moon. Yeah, I know it's summertime and sometimes we despise that sun. Please, Lord, send a cloud and cover it up. Right? It's still God's creation. And that great big giant ball of magnetism flying through the air gives life to our plants on earth. Which, by the way, take in carbon dioxide, things which everybody thinks is the enemy. No, if there is no carbon dioxide, all the plants die. They take in the carbon dioxide and they give us what we need, oxygen. It's amazing what God has done. And it's happening outside right there in front of our faces. If God has spoken and God has declared, He told Adam and Eve, the seed of the woman is going to crush the head of the serpent. Guess what? Satan is going to finally and ultimately and completely be cast out, cast down, and never more will he molest us ever again. Because God said so. Maybe that's why Satan doesn't like people talking about the sun, the moon, and the stars. Because it's a witness against him. Look up. See what God is doing. See what God has done. And honor Him and glorify Him that He keeps His Word and by all things sustains things by His power. Would you bow your heads with me as we pray? Our Father in heaven,